When it comes to playtime, never let your squad down. Unlock elite gaming tech at Lenovo.com. Push your gameplay beyond performance with 13th Gen Intel Core processors. Upgrade to smooth, high-quality streaming with Intel Wi-Fi 6E. And maximize game performance with enhanced overclocking. Win the tech search and head to Lenovo.com. Lenovo.
Lowe's knows that free is just better. That's why MyLowe's Rewards is free to join. As a member, you earn points towards MyLowe's money on eligible purchases, get exclusive free gifts, and earn free shipping at Silver Key status, all on top of weekly member-only deals. Don't wait. Join MyLowe's Rewards for free today and start saving more. Lowe's. We help. You save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
If you want to pump your body and expand your mind, there's only one place to go. Mind Pump. Mind Pump. With your hosts, Sal DiStefano, Adam Schaefer, and Justin Andrews.
You just found the most downloaded fitness, health, and entertainment podcast. This is Mind Pump. Right in today's episode, we answered live callers. People called in, and we coached them live on air. But this was after the intro portion. Today's intro was 50 minutes long. In the intro, we talk about fitness, studies, nutrition, personal training. It's a great time. By the way, if you want to be on an episode like this, email us your question at live@mindpumpmedia.com. This episode is brought to you by some sponsors. Today's episode was brought to you by Organifi. Organifi, in today's episode, we talked about their Shilajit gummies. Shilajit is an Ayurvedic compound, and it's been shown to have some pretty cool health benefits. They put it in gummy form. Go check them out. Go to Organifi.com. That's Organifi.com/mindpump. Use the code mindpump, get 20% off. This episode is also brought to you by Rock Recovery Center. If you go to rockrecoverycenter.com/mindpump, you can register for a free scholarship. So 4 months, $60,000 scholarship for you or a loved one who's struggling with substance abuse. We know the owners of this place. We know the people who run the place. We trust them. Go check them out. We also have a webinar coming up. Adam and I are going to be teaching coaches and trainers how to leverage social media. It's totally free. Go to trainerwebinar.com. Finally, we have a program sale. MAPS Anabolic is combined with a no BS six-pack formula. You can get both of them together for $59.99. If you're interested, go to mapsfebruary.com. All right, here comes the show. You haven't gotten any stronger. You haven't lost any more body fat. You haven't built any more muscle over the last 4 weeks. It's a plateau.
Let's start
seeing results again. Speak we have yourself. Five plateau busters. Five of them, and they're effective. First one might surprise you. Take a week off and then start back up again with a different approach. Let's start there.
I like that. I think that there's a good chance that a majority of people listening to this podcast, I'd say a high percentage of them would consider themselves fitness people.
Yeah, especially if you're plateaued, especially if you've been working out.
Yeah, that's my point. So that's who I'm talking to, because there's obviously this advice is specific to that group of people, right? We have our average clients that we train, which were nobody, the client who couldn't string 30 days together of training.
Yeah, it's not a plateau if you're not working out.
That's right. So if you can't be consistent for 30 days, this probably doesn't fit you. Now, we do have a lot of people that are very, very consistent and are always looking for the next competitive edge, the next supplement, the next program. They never take time off, or rarely ever take time off, and this is like one of the huge hacks. And I think all of us have shared stories of our personal journey of when we realized this, you know, what's the minimum effective dose, and that most of us tend to overdo it, being fitness fanatics, because we take a week off, expecting to come back. Oh God, I'm gonna be so much weaker and so far behind. And you were stronger.
Mm-hmm. So when you look at the best, most scientifically planned strength training programs in the world, they tend to be, or they're almost all relegated to strength sports, like Olympic lifting, powerlifting, mainly because they're objective, right? You have to objectively measure your performance. Olympic lifting in particular was, you know, it's funded by countries competing against each other in the Olympics. So they're very scientifically done. And they all include what will be commonly called in the fitness space a deload week or deload periods of time. Deload simply means you're reducing your volume, your intensity, your workout significantly for a certain period of time to come back and to continue progressing. And the data shows that this works exceptionally well. In fact, there was a study, we've talked about this many times. This is a short study. So these people, I don't think even needed a deload week, but what they did is they showed that when you compare two groups of people, one group working out every week, another group taking a week off after every 3 weeks over 12-week period. So over the 12-week period, one group took off 3 weeks, right?
That study was so crazy when this came out. Like the fact that you could, 12 weeks is short. We already talk about how that's a short study. To think that the group who took off 3 weeks out of the 12 weeks, a third. Got the same results as the people that went every week.
That's right.
That's crazy.
From a muscle development standpoint, right? So we're not talking about stamina and endurance. That might be a little different, but like from building muscle, they were the same. So what does this tell us? Well, I think what you have with the fitness fanatic, what tends to happen is we naturally start to veer towards away from what is ideal, and we start to move towards what is tolerable or what our bodies can tolerate. In other words, what's the upper limit of what I can handle? And you get away with this for a little while until the cumulative stress on your body starts to compound. This is what happens. You go from week one, week two, week three, week four, week five, and so on. This stress starts to compound. And then what happens is you're just breaking yourself down and healing and coming back to baseline, breaking yourself down, healing back to baseline. So you don't improve at all. And so taking a week off, just that alone oftentimes gets people through plateaus.
I have a theory on why that's so common. What do you guys think? Why do you think that's so common?
I think it's common for two reasons. I think one, fitness fanatics like to work out, so we like to see how much we get away with. But two, I think that adding more works for a while until it stops working.
So I think it's something different than both those. I think that because we all would agree and say that there was a period of time where we thought this or did this, and you chased soreness as an indicator of a good workout.
Gotta be a factor. Gotta be.
Mm-hmm. And as you start off, it's really easy to get sore because everything is new, right? All the movements are new.
See all this new progression.
And then you get a little strong and you add a little more weight. And then eventually you start to slow up and adapt. And then the soreness really starts to diminish because the body is adapted and become, and you keep chasing the soreness. And your way of doing that is
Two levers. There's the volume or there's intensity, and you're going to crank, you know, one or the other,
or both.
Try and get there to get to that sore
in
feeling.
Pursuit of that soreness. And I'm very much so guilty of this, even as a trainer, should know better. Of like, oh, I didn't get sore enough, so next workout I'm applying more. And so I think most of these people end up here relatively quick within chasing the pain of thinking that is an indicator of a good workout, and it sets you up for this. And then let me tell you, some of the people who chase that soreness are some of the fitness fanatics that keep on going, and that they end up in this place for a long period until they have that moment where they accidentally take a week off, or somehow it ends up happening where they take a week off and then they come back. And then a lot of times they don't even make the connection still yet. If they really were to be honest,
the fear that they're really going to set themselves back if they stop this progression that they've created in this environment and this type of habit that they worked so hard to achieve. This habit and consistency is like everything that's been working. So now, you know, if that formula doesn't apply, then I'm just going to bring myself all the way back to the beginning.
And it's, by the way, this can sneak up on you too. Even if you think you're being smart about your training, I'll give you a great example. You've been training for a while and you're getting relatively consistently stronger. So either week in, week out, or every other week or so, you're progressing on every lift. Well, here's what's happening that you don't realize. You haven't added sets. You haven't added new exercises. It's the same routine. How come all of a sudden it's too much for me? Because you've added weight to the bar, or you've added reps, you've added volume. So every time you get stronger, or every time you do a couple more reps, you've actually added volume to your routine. So over time of progressing, you're actually progressively adding volume until it becomes something your body can no longer tolerate. And the first sign of it is a plateau where you see no progress. Yeah, and I did say over 4 weeks, because I think that's a fair measurement of plateauing, at least a month for most people, maybe a little longer, but definitely not a week, right? You can't expect yourself to progress every week.
Yeah. I mean, another reason why this sneaks up on people is I feel like they misunderstand what is the right dose for the body and what they can tolerate.
Yeah, that's it.
And so they end up getting to this place where it's hard to read this because they're like, oh, I'm fine, or I feel good after my workout. And the you don't understand just how resilient the body is and how well it adapts. And you're right. You probably are fine. The body can handle the punishment that you're giving it all the time and handle it so well, you're not getting sore anymore. But it's definitely got to a point where it's like, you ain't getting,
not adapting.
You're not getting any more results because so much of our energy and effort is put towards being able to just handle it and handle all the intensity and volume putting towards it, that you're not giving enough resources to go build, adapt, and add strength.
Now, the second part to this is you come back with a different approach. So it could be as different as changing your split routine. It could be changing the exercises, the rep range, the tempo, or the focus. But if you come back with the same routine as before, you're going to quickly run into a plateau again. By the way, the most challenging part about this is the week off. People are always like, well, what do I do? Now, the easy answer is nothing. But I know fitness fanatics don't want to do nothing. Doug, give me the link for the guide. We have a 7-day overtraining rescue guide. It's free. You go to mindpumpfree.com, and it's a 7-day guide that tells you what to do every single day that accelerates recovery and gets you ready to work out again. It includes diet strategies and stuff like that along with it, which is pretty cool. Which takes me to the second one, which for a lot of people, the reason why they're plateauing is they're simply not eating enough.
Yeah.
And so I like to make this very simple. Add a 200 to 500 calorie meal, or make it easy, shake. And I see this with clients all the time. The ones that I knew struggled with going in a calorie surplus because they're so worried about getting fatter. They always wanted to be lean.
All my female clients, this was very difficult to convey.
Totally. Yeah. And so what I would do is I would come up with a shake for them, because when it was prescriptive, sometimes I was more effective. And the shake would consist of protein powder, some kind of a healthy fat, in a kind of a milk, whether it be a nut milk because they can't have dairy, or dairy, throw in some fruit. And they'd have 200 to 500 calorie extra shake that they would add to their food. And for those clients, this would get things moving again.
Yeah, this is so true that there's a saying in the bodybuilding world that has been permeating for years that there's no such thing as overtraining, just under eating.
Right.
Because
that's because there's some truth to this.
Well,
it's not 100% true.
Well, where the truth comes from is that most of these people that started that were on anabolic steroids. And when you're taking all kinds of steroids that keep your anabolic signal at peak levels 24/7, 7 days a week, and you're also taking stacks of hormones and things that help recovery and do things like that, boy, you can really push those levers of intensity and volume. And as long as you're feeding the body and giving it more calories and more nutrients to keep building and get away with so much more than the average person. Yeah. And so that's become a popular saying in the space.
There is some truth for even the natural person, though, for the person who's afraid of eating more calories, who's afraid of, you know, and it is more often women than men that you see. They're just like, they got lean. They're fit. They want to get stronger. They don't know why. You look at their diet. Okay, you're eating 1,700 calories a day. You add 300 calories to that and boom. Strength, right away.
Jumps right back.
And so just if that's you, add a 200 to 500 calorie shake with a decent amount of protein in it. Just add that every single day and you'll probably see yourself progressing within a few days. Next up is to put a focus on sleep. What I mean by that is make sure you sleep 8 hours every night, go to bed at the same time every night, and wake up at the same time every day. So it's the same every single day.
Quality sleep.
And that's it. And then give it 14 days. Now the people who I see get crazy results from this are younger individuals, typically 20-year-olds. When they do this consistently, because they all have crappy sleep and they stay up late.
It's not even a consideration otherwise.
Not even when they do this, it's almost like, you know, I'm thinking of a kid right now who was in his early 20s, who I worked with when I was in my 30s, early 30s, and I had him do this for 14 days. He gained 5 pounds of lean body mass. Yeah. He was already muscular and strong, did nothing else. 5 pounds of lean body mass in 2 weeks. And he was tripping out. And of course, it was one of my favorite, I told you so, moments in my entire career.
That's interesting that you say that group. I would actually make the argument, and maybe this is just an example of the difference in our clientele. I saw this a lot with my high-performing CEO type of clients because they...
For sure, that too.
And a lot of times what it is that they have and this would happen while I was training them and while I was managing volume and intensity. And so I know that, I think we're not applying too much. But what I'm not taking into consideration is this high-performing, high-stress individual that works 6 days a week, 12-hour days, has got all this pressure on them at work. Even though I think my training is relatively moderate for the average person, I'm not taking into consideration how poorly this person is sleeping and their stress. This is actually when that started to come together for me as a coach and a trainer, was starting to recognize this and go like, oh, wow, I really have to learn how to modify my training volume intensity, because this, what I'm applying should be fine, yet we're at a hard plateau right now and I'm monitoring all these things. What I'm not monitoring, or I wasn't monitoring at that time, was those clients' sleep patterns and their stress levels. And those clients that were like that, they were, oh, Adam, I only need 4 hours of sleep. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. We're just killers in business.
Yeah.
And because of that, like getting that person, like convincing them that, listen, just trust me, prioritize your sleep for a couple weeks and let's see what happens. And then boom, they would
blows their mind.
Yeah.
I had a very similar experience with that, especially with one of my most difficult clients in terms of like, what is that thing that's going to move the progress? It was always like this, we're hitting a wall. And I knew it was because of stress and work and demand and like work, waking up in the middle of the night. The only time we had like crazy progress was when she went on vacation for a week in a tropical place, got a ton of sun and a lot of sleep, came back and like, and lost weight, and then everything was stronger. And it was like an immediate thing. And still didn't like really, like I tried really hard to convey, like that was a huge component that we're lacking, you know, and look what happened. But yeah, that was the most difficult thing, is like when it comes to sleep, it's like, how do you convince somebody that's high performing and is just a killer to slow down?
It's a 14-day challenge. Try it out and see what happens.
Yeah.
Next up, and you'll know if this is you, lift with lighter weight and much better form. And this is, you know, this is you if you're the one that likes to push the weight a lot. You like to go heavier.
Yeah.
You don't want to go lighter. You sacrifice form a little bit, or at least you know you could go deeper in your squat or your lift or whatever if you went lighter. If that's you, this is a crazy plateau buster. This is one of my favorite ones with these individuals. I would make them go lighter, and I'd have a fuller range of motion, slow down the reps, and boom, muscle would grow all over them. This actually happened to me in my late teens, early 20s, because that was me up until I started figuring out form was really important. And I went a little lighter, had a deeper range of motion, and my body just developed.
Well, I imagine in the same category, that type of person has a workout partner. And I would say fire them and start doing it by yourself and start really getting into the nitty gritty of your form and, you know, what you can actually lift without momentum.
These were my clients that were like my ex athletic or really strong dudes that were in their 40s and 50s, and they still, you know, could lift heavy, but they had to use all the wraps and the straps and the everything to do it. And they were constantly talking about their knees and their hips and their back and all stuff like that, because they just didn't want to let go of, because they could bench press 315 or because they could still squat 400 pounds that they needed to or wanted to. And it was all ego driving them to do that, when it was like, listen, let me strip the weight in half and show you just as good, if not better, results. And getting them to trust me to do that was always really difficult. That was the client that I was most challenged with getting this point across. But it was always amazing when you did, because all those things would be better. A lot of the joint pain would go away. All of a sudden, they weren't waking up like that. They could move better. They felt better. And then they actually saw gains. And then when we came back to test our strength, and it hit PRs. And so it was like they were training in that heavy mode for so long that they haven't allowed themselves to do that. And many times it was ego driven, because they didn't want to.
Now, you should see, now I go to a commercial gym now, and where I go in the morning, a lot of the guys in there working out are in their 20s. And this is very true for them. They like to go heavy, cut their reps short, especially on things like overhead press and, you know, bench press and stuff like that. And if they just went lighter, full range of motion, they'd be blown away. Now, the next one is the opposite, lift heavier. This is, you know, if this is you, because you're afraid to go heavier, or you use the same weights all the time.
My female clients.
And this female clients, it was more, whereas the, you know, go lighter was more, you know, advantageous or more valuable.
My egomaniac, egomaniac dudes lift lighter.
Yeah.
My girls, safe, precautious, don't want to push.
Let's go heavier.
Yeah.
And challenge yourself a little bit with how much you can lift. And if that's you, this could be huge. Now, this was one of my favorite buttons with female clients.
Yeah.
They'd hire me. I'd see what they were doing, and I could see right away, like, you can add 20 pounds to the bar. No, I can't. Like, yeah, you can. I'll show you. And then they add it, and lo and behold, perfectly fine. And then we start progressing again.
When we talk about this, it always reminds me of kind of how we all got together, because this was when you first sent me over MAPS Anabolic. And I tell the story all the time that, like, what was it that made me get on the phone with you and go like, oh, this is brilliant. And it was at that time, first of all, so the audience understands, 60, 70%, maybe more of our clientele are female, middle-aged female clients wanting to get in shape, lose weight, most common client. And one of the most common things is they didn't lift heavy. Getting them to lift heavy, to squat, to deadlift, to lift these big lifts, 5x5 type training. And, you know, as a trainer, like, realizing how valuable it was and what a hack it was to get those clients to do that. I mean, I would blow my female clients' minds by just simply their first phase I trained them would be heavy lifting, because it was so foreign and so new. Yep. The muscle would pile on, they'd lean out, their metabolism and appetite would go. It was just, and it took me 10 years of my career to get to that point where I realized, like, oh, this is how I start all my clients now. And that was the same time that Sal and I had met virtually. And he had sent over MAPS Anabolic, and I looked at it. I'm like, yes, like, this is literally what I'm like. And so
it was phase one.
Yeah. And so it was phase one. And I knew that had to been why the thought process behind it. And I was like, okay, we're on the same wavelength. And so whenever we give this tip, it reminds me of kind of the inception of Mind Pump and how it all started.
Speaking of, you know, working out and progress and stuff, there was a study that was just published. Jeff Nippert actually was one of the people that conducted the study. So people don't know, he's a fitness influencer, smart guy, scientist. And
Justin loves him.
Yeah. I don't know a lot about the guy.
But
he doesn't come on my feed.
They did a study where they compared loose form to strict form on a single joint exercise, the bicep curl. So they only picked one exercise. I like the way they did it. One arm did a cheat curl with more weight. The other arm in the same body did a strict curl,
okay,
with lighter weight,
okay,
and they did this study, which I like that. I think that's performed really well. And
how long? Give me this stuff.
I got to pull it up. It was long enough to see if there was progress. I'll pull it up for you.
Okay.
But what they found in the study was there was no difference in progress, which just goes to show the cheat reps, you're just adding risk for no reason. Yeah, you're at. By the way, this is a single joint exercise too. Yeah. Single joint exercises, cheating on a single joint exercise like a curl, not that big of a deal from a risk perspective. You still have a higher risk of injury, not that big. Double, compound lifts.
Oh, yeah.
You cheat on those, your risk of injury goes to the roof. Like, you do a squat perfectly, very safe. You do a cheat squat, whatever that looks like, and you've got yourself
I love this study, and I love this point, because this reminds me of being a trainer. And one of the things I love to do, especially when I was in like crazy shredded shape, is I would be in my little tank top, stringer, cut off, like looking shredded. And I would go next to somebody and I would be lifting like the lightest weight with like just strict, perfect form. And I knew when you look like that, when you stand out as like the 1% in the gym fit wise, you know that it grabs the attention of the people inside there, especially when you're a trainer in the facility and they see you there all the time. And I always got people to ask me questions. I always see you lifting super lightweight, like, but you look amazing. And then I would be able to explain this to them. That, yeah, this idea that you need to put all this weight on, you can build a lot of muscle through strict good form and lightweight, and it doesn't take loading so much.
No. Well, this has always been my criticism of structuring workouts in a competitive environment, like a CrossFit or a, you know, Orange Theory class, or like, you know, these class settings that, you know, really like reward people for this, you know, being able to kind of cheat their way through or like add more weight, but it's bragging rights in terms of what they're able to do. But, you know, now we just take a lot of the quality out of the actual movement, and the value of it drops substantially.
So it was an 8-week study, so 2 months, which I think is long enough to show if there's a bit of a difference. But the reason why I like the results is it confirms just what I've seen training people. But I will say this, just to defend the bodybuilders, because bodybuilders will sometimes be the ones to argue for cheat reps. In fact, the term cheat reps was created by bodybuilders. Arnold,
it's in his encyclopedia.
The first strength training book I ever bought and read was his encyclopedia. And there is there is pictures and advice for a cheat curl that's in there. Here's why I think sometimes experienced lifters, especially in single joint exercises, I think cheat, you know, compound lifts is you're playing with fire and it's dumb. but some single joint exercises, a lateral, you know, a curl, a tricep press down, fine. I think sometimes why experienced lifters will notice better progress is not because they're cheating or it's more weight, but rather they've changed the exercise. It's a different lift now. So if you look at a cheat curl versus a strict curl, or a cheat press down versus a regular press down, or a lateral strict versus one that's not as strict, they're actually different exercises. They're different techniques. Mm. In fact, you could get really good at one and you'll have some carryover to the other one, but not as much as if you practiced the other one. So like a cheat curl, for example, it's kind of its own lift. It's very close to a strict curl or related. So I think it's just different, which is why experience
allows the momentum. And
I mean, I love this point too, because inevitably I would get someone that would ask this and challenge it, especially because that was, and that's how I know it's in that book, because people would be like, well, I read that Arnold said cheat reps. And I would tell my clients that you have to earn the right to do that.
Yeah.
Like we're going to train in such strict form that you are so connected to everything we're trying to activate, and you can master every exercise we're doing with strict, perfect form. And then we earn the right to put some English on it and to cheat and to create a new exercise in a sense. It's like, until then, we're going to stick to incredibly strict form and the basic movements. We're going to master the basics with perfect form and technique. And then we can start playing with these unique movements and exercises and stuff that we create. Yeah. And otherwise, you lose the benefits because you can't even perform the exercise with perfect strict form. And now you're cheating it. So now you're losing out on even more.
I mean, the way I would even just counter what I said earlier is there's better ways to add novelty. There's a better way to add novelty to your exercise than doing a cheat loose version of the same exercise that you've been doing. And why is that better? You haven't increased, you know, one thing with exercise, especially strength training, is if you're going to increase your risk of injury, you better have a far better return in terms of progress. Once the risk of injury outweighs the return, it makes no sense whatsoever. It's
just frivolous.
It's just dumb. Because if you look at people who've been doing this for long, long periods of time, the thing that gets in the way is injury. Always. It's the worst thing that gets in the way.
Yeah.
It's not family stuff. It's not whatever. I'm talking about people who've been doing this for decades. When you look at their careers of training or whatever, and you see, oh, you stopped doing this exercise. Why? Or you had to change the way you trained. What happened? Or wow, over here you took 6 months off. That's the
ultimate deterrent to your entire program is getting injured.
I don't know what side this is of me or how weird this is, right? I don't know if you guys agree with this, but I love biomechanics and human physiology so much that there's art and beauty in it.
It's a skill. For sure.
And so just like when somebody, and I'm not a fan of this sport, but a lot of people are, and the people that are fans of the sport understand this. Like when you watch like something like ice skating, it's the way they move so flawlessly on the ice is what, it's not that they just stay up and then they jump. It's like how flawless it is in the movement and the technique is what makes the score so high and what makes it so beautiful to watch. I feel the same way about exercise. One of the most attractive qualities that I've ever thought in a female is when I come in and I can see a woman performing a squat like flawless. Yeah, that's so attractive to me. Yeah, I think that's like watching the body move so perfectly the way it's supposed to on an exercise like that. And so bastardizing that to me is just like, I don't know. It's like nails.
I was thinking of Sal doing a deadlift and I'm like, that's very Brian Boitano-esque. So beautiful.
I forgot about that ice skater. That's hilarious. Nice.
Magical.
Yeah, nice. All right, so I have a cool study, another study to bring up. This is on omega-3 fatty acids. This has just been published, so which actually led me to finding a couple other studies on omega-3 fatty acids. So in this particular study, they found that omega-3 fatty acids reduced aging in individuals or slowed down the aging process in individuals who consume them regularly, as measured by, you know, there's biological measures that we look at that can signify biological aging. And it was a large study. People who ate a gram of omega-3 fatty acids a day aged slower. They aged slower. Also, they also found in another study that people who ate higher levels of omega-3 fatty acids had higher average scores on tests of abstract reasoning, and they had larger average volumes in the hippocampus area of their brains. So omega-3 fatty acids, they're it's probably a good idea,
pretty necessary, yeah,
to supplement with them. But even better would be to consume foods that are high in them.
Yeah. Sure. When I hear some of that, you know, that makes me always curious about, and you're probably the person to ask this, cause I have no idea how they, like, something like this would measure up. But say, for example, like a product like, Shilajit from Organifi, mm-hmm. like the one of the benefits in there is skins, wrinkle health. Like there's it hits so many things. How does something like omega-3s measure up to a product like that? Are they equal? Are they different? Are they same? Like,
no, let's be clear. Omega-3s are essential fatty acids. There is no essential Shilajit. Like you have to have a certain amount of omega-3 fatty acids just to thrive.
Now, is that for like you said, for the skin, right? For that exact, the things that are inside Shilajit that have benefits towards the skin, is it the same or different? And are they something that you would be synergistic?
You can take them both. There's nothing competing there. The omega-3 fatty acids are really interesting in terms of longevity, health, aging, inflammation. I think in these studies, they're looking at people that eat them. By the way, for the average person, if you ate sardines, which people confuse sardines with anchovies, mm-hmm. sardines taste great, especially if you add salt, lemon, whatever. You ate a can of sardines every other day, you'd get plenty of omega-3 fatty acids. Shilajit is far different, a little bit more mysterious, even though it's been used for a long time. Shilajit is an Ayurvedic compound. It's actually, it's if you go in the Himalayan mountains, you really find it. It's this black tarry substance that comes from the decomposition of plants over centuries. So it's mm-hmm. like centuries old decomposed plant material that they've used
raw organic matter
that they've used in Ayurvedic medicine.
So does it make it rare because it takes that long in order to?
So here's what's crazy about that. You just said that. So Shilajit, I knew about it for a long time, right?
I knew about it because I remember when Organifi did it, and I didn't know what the hell it was. And you're like, "Oh my god, I've
known." Psyched, psyched. Okay, because I didn't know of any really good providers, or I should say, it wasn't popular, but it should be, because if you look at the studies on it, it's pretty interesting. It's good for brain health, raises testosterone, good for fertility. It's got all these like pretty cool benefits. Been used for a long time. Organifi went with a company called PrimaV, which uses real Shilajit. Here's why that's important. So the real stuff, the real, like it's, you know, decomposed plant matter, hundreds of years old or whatever. There's a lot of companies now, because it's so popular, that are making fake Shilajit. They're making it in a lab. They're taking fulvic acid. They're adding it to other things. Yes. And they're trying to, and they're creating, it's lab created Shilajit. It's not the same stuff that they use and Ayurvedic medicine. So Organifi sources theirs from PrimaV, which is real. That's real Shilajit. Other companies, you got to be careful where you get it from, because it's
lab-made. So hard, so hard for the consumer, man.
You wouldn't know that. How would you know this?
Well, it reminds me of the same challenge we have with our other partner with Juve, Red Light.
Yeah.
You know, like it's like just because it's Red Light doesn't mean you get the same benefits as like the.
No, it's like a stoplight. Yeah. That's red.
Yeah. So I know, but the average person, they're not making that connection. They just, what they constantly hear is that red light therapy, red light. And then all of a sudden it gets popular. Yeah. And then all of a sudden all these brands pop up, and then you order one and you have no idea the difference. And there's even a little bit, and I'm sure that that's what these Shilajit companies are doing, is you pixie dust a little bit of the real stuff in there. Then you have more of the fake synthetic stuff. So you could still kind of claim that it's partially real.
Here's what happens with Ayurvedic or Chinese medicine. Sometimes people will take something, and what they expect, they don't expect to feel great results. They think like, oh, I think it's feeling better. I think it's helping. It's supposed to help me. And we sometimes expect that from those kinds of compounds. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you straight up, if you take real Shilajit, you'll feel it within 30 days. You'll know you're taking real Shilajit. So if you're taking a product that says Shilajit and you've been taking it for 2 months and you notice nothing, you know, there's no difference whatsoever. Probably fake. Yeah. Because it's one of those things that you.
Well, I mean, I feel
a lot of people will.
I feel the same thing about the red light. Like, if you stand in front of that red light consistently three times a week for 10, 12 minutes.
I mean, I think that should be the case for anything, right?
Right.
Do or take. Yeah.
So, but back to the omega fatty acids. Like, I was actually wondering about this because I was like, oh man, I'm so like mad at myself half the time because I'm not into fish, and I would go through these cycles where I'm like trying to reintroduce it. I'm like, well, I can handle salmon, you know, I can handle some of these things. And then it's like, I'm getting all this conflicting information now that basically all the fish we're getting now have like these heavy metals in them and like super toxic.
This is why I said sardines. Sardines are very low. So the fish that eat lots of fish, so you guys swordfish, that's like a big predator fish. Because of the amount of fish it consumes, high levels. Sardines, very low, very, very low in heavy metals. One of the safest, cleanest types of fish that you can
see. Really? So you want the prey. Interesting. Not the predator.
Yeah. Swordfish, if I'm not mistaken, the amount of mercury in swordfish, I think you wouldn't, you should
eat it. It's alarming,
like,
right?
I think it's like once a month, I think you should consume it at most or something like that. I don't know, Doug. Maybe you could look this up.
Yeah, look at, because it. I keep reading about that. Not to mention like the red tide and like some things where you get this bacteria algae that like stays in your system. And so anyway.
Well, dude, if you just bought high EPA, you know, omega-3 fatty acids and took.
That's what I mean. Supplement
those every day.
The move for me.
You're totally fine. Swordfish is considered a high mercury fish. How often do they say you're supposed to?
They say consuming it could lead to mercury poisoning.
Yeah, they won't let, like, pregnant women are not supposed to eat swordfish, which sucks. Swordfish is delicious. It's great.
Yeah, I've had it.
It's actually it's the meatiest. Meaty. It's the most meat like fish.
That's why I like it.
Yeah, that's right.
Like that, not like fish sticks.
Yeah, so. That doesn't count.
Yeah,
you know, speaking of like the brain and health and stuff like that, Justin, you shared that interesting data on creatine and head trauma.
Yeah.
Which is...
Yeah, I got that from Dr. Andy Galpin. And because of concussions, I'm always like pretty interested in latest science for treatments and things like that. And, you know, preventatively, I guess there's this, what do you call it? Secondary impact syndrome something like that. So after... I guess a lot of the damage comes not just the first concussion, but it's the head trauma afterwards.
It's the if you get a second or third, it's far more damaging.
It's compounding, than the first one. Right? Yes. And apparently they studied whether or not like they were deficient or they had a good amount of creatine, and it was substantially different. Like the amount of damage, you got a lot more damage if you didn't have creatine.
It's
in your system.
Protective.
It's very protective.
If you play a sport that involves some risk of head trauma, or you're an athlete, you should have to take creatine.
I wish I'd have done that. I would have taken a lot more. I mean, consistently as an athlete.
I kind of feel like that's every sport. Name a sport that comes to mind where every sport that has a ball, you could potentially get hit in the head with the ball. Yep. So it makes sense there. Any sport where you're running, I mean, you trip, hit your head. I mean,
really, it's just providing.
It's like a no-brainer for any athlete.
It's just providing more energy for your cells, which includes your brain. And when you have lots of available ATP and you have trauma, the healing process is going to be much better. If you're energy depleted and then you have an injury, you're screwed. So I think that's what it's.
I'm assuming that's why the football protocol is right after they have this protocol of concussion where they can't play for at least another day or week or like that, depending on it.
So preceding
one more than really what has happened. The damage is done. It's just that, but it has compounding effects later on.
Speaking of compounding effects, I got to tell you, man, I talk about eating your previous words. You know, when they were talking back in the day, here in California over cannabis legalization, I was this huge proponent and I said, it's not going to cause more problems and it's not going to get more people to smoke it. And being illegal makes it more attractive and blah, 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 blah. And it turns out it's completely wrong.
Really?
It's super wrong. The cannabis use has skyrocketed in places, in states where it's legalized, skyrocketed. And now there's data showing, I mean, not great stuff. At all.
So before you go, let me poke holes in that, because it's like when it's illegal, okay, who is raising their hand and going like, I'm smoking the illegal drug? Like right now, I don't care what anybody says, we could not get a good gauge of how many people do cocaine.
Yeah.
Just fact. Why? Because it's illegal. Right. We're not measuring transactions. We have no systems. Ain't nobody raising their hand, you know.
Nobody's measuring pinky nail length.
Yeah. We're not doing any of that. So then if all of a sudden cocaine was legalized tomorrow and the regular cocaine user could go down to a pharmacy and it's now being tracked because it's being taxed, and we said you would show massive increase.
That's logical, but that's not how they're measuring it. How they're measuring it is people admitting themselves to rehab. So people used to admit themselves to rehab for cannabis, what they call marijuana abuse syndrome. That never made the top 10 with rehab facilities.
Okay, so that's interesting.
As it's become legalized, okay, over the years.
Are these people dabbing or like
do you,
what?
Do you, oh, bro, do you want to, so, okay, I'll trip you out. Okay?
Yeah.
So marijuana use disorder is what they call it. People are addicted. People are actually going to rehab. They are themselves saying, I need help with this.
Yeah.
On the list of drugs or substances that send people to rehab, where do you think marijuana falls?
I mean, before this or now?
Now.
Oh, well, now you're saying it. You already told us it's already high. I would have guessed it way low in the first place.
It's third.
Third?
It's the third most common.
What's one and two?
One is alcohol. And then nicotine, believe it or not. But nicotine.
People check themselves into rehab?
Not rehab, but they count people who say, I'm addicted and I need help.
Well, okay, so wait a second, Sal. Are they counting the marijuana
No, this is, if you look at the, so if you look at the amount of people now going to rehab, and we can actually ask our friends at Rock Recovery about this. I would love to ask them.
We are definitely going to ask.
Like, have you seen a rise in people who come to you?
Because how does this study show one but not the other? I don't understand how you're saying that they put cigarettes as two because.
I think because cigarettes have always been legal that they can see how many, you know, how addicted people are. Alcohol, they're using people who are reporting. Self-reporting.
So these are just legal drugs.
Yes.
No,
they have opiates on here too. Inhalants are number five. Heroin's number
I would have thought opiates would have been higher.
Yeah.
I would have thought I would have been alcohol one, opiates two.
Yeah.
But I didn't want, I wouldn't have guessed cigarettes are in there, and I wouldn't have guessed that cigarettes is just self-reported I'm addicted, because of course that's high.
Yeah.
And I also think, by the way, if they're measuring this by people reporting that I'm addicted to marijuana, that, like, for example, they do surveys that say, do you use marijuana more than five times a week? And if you do, you're considered addicted to marijuana. And a bunch of people would say, I use marijuana more than five times a week.
Yeah.
And now that's where this is coming from.
People that use it like every day.
Yes.
Yeah, that won't think they have an addiction.
Yes, too, so. 100%. So, I mean, your study's flawed. Bro.
Well. So here's the deal. So I did look
it up. Not to burst your bubble.
I did look it up, and I did.
We know it's not good for memory. Right?
I highlighted that. I forgot the study.
Yeah.
No, I did. I did read a lot of articles about rehab facility centers saying it is. It is growing quite a bit.
To me, that is the best gauge for this.
Yeah.
Because that if people are checking into rehab centers to help them out with that's a big sign. Because I don't think anyone's checking themselves into rehab centers for cigarettes.
No.
So like, I don't think there's a lot of people checking themselves in for marijuana either. But I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so hearing from Rock Recovery from those guys or them, and they tell me like, yeah, Adam, we've seen, you know, a huge rise. Then I would be very shocked, and then that would carry weight to this conversation. Mm-hmm. But if they don't, then I think self-reporting, are you addicted? And then of course, you know, smoking marijuana on a 3 to 5 times a day or more, if that's what they categorize as addicted, is
so Yale Medicine. So this is based off of Yale Medicine. They did a study and they said that 10% who begin smoking cannabis will form an addiction or cannabis use disorder. 30% of current users meet the criteria for cannabis addiction.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's pretty high.
I would probably meet that.
So come the on. CDC reports that approximately 3 to 10. Anyway, my point with it isn't necessarily that, although I do think it's interesting. I would love to hear the guys from Rock Recovery. I'd like to, because they do this, like, okay, how often do you see this?
Yeah.
And has it increased, right? But here's the crazy part. We're now having studies on schizophrenia. So, you know, they used to say how there might be a connection between cannabis use and schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
Schizophrenia, since the legalization of cannabis, has tripled.
Really?
And they think they're making the connection to cannabis.
It's like an epigenetic abuse. Sort of factor to that, where it unlocks
just the way it,
or?
It affects the brain over time, it can induce mental illness.
Yeah. What else increases schizophrenia? Do things like Adderall and ADD type medications?
I think psychedelics too. They've found certain.
That's
ones.
A good question, and I think cannabis is listed as a psychedelic, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know about Adderall, but methamphetamine, sure.
Well, because I know DMT, a personal
Well, the reason
story.
Why I say that is what has been the rise in the last decade with your kids are getting medication like that like crazy compared to just where it was 10 years. Yes.
There are, but the data on it's... So, Doug, if you if you type in marijuana and schizophrenia, we have pretty good studies now that show that it's a risk.
Again, not saying that there's not situations where we're... But again, a broad study like that, when we have things like Adderall being prescribed at much higher rates than we ever had in previous decades.
Yeah, I don't think that's good either.
Of course, no. I think that's way more likely to cause schizophrenia than marijuana use also.
I don't know if there's a connection between the two, to be honest with you. I don't know if there's a connection between Adderall and schizophrenia that they've made. I could see where you're going with that because I think the strong forms, like when people use meth, That's a common
shit. The regular. I'll never forget the first time I tried an Adderall pill as an adult. It was
schizophrenia.
No, but I mean maybe no. a little bit. You know what I'm saying? Like that. It is strong.
Who are you talking to, Adam? I don't know. What did that say there, Doug?
According to this, young men at the highest risk for schizophrenia linked with cannabis use.
Yeah. It's pretty wild. And I'd love to hear from. By the way, we got to say this. Rock Recovery does a scholarship. I think they're doing it this month, where if you go to their site, maybe Doug, you can get me their link here so I can read it off properly. If you go to their site, you can enter in to win a free scholarship. It's a $50,000, if I'm not mistaken, scholarship to go and get rehab. And I think it's like 4 months, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Is that it?
Okay. No, it's actually longer than that.
It's longer than that. It's okay. Pretty awesome. And by the way, everybody gets help. So they don't, somebody
wins. 4 months. Is that what you said?
Yeah, I did.
4 months.
Oh, what's the link for them, Doug?
It's rockrecoverycenter.com/mindpump.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so back to this debate.
Yeah.
It says it doesn't directly cause schizophrenia, but it can exacerbate the symptoms of the disorder, leading to misdiagnosis or worsening of symptoms. Yeah. Well, what is weed doing? Is weed directly affecting schizophrenia?
That's inducing it. So people who
didn't have it,
that's right.
Mechanism there. Like,
Here.
I also would want to
listen. Let me ask you guys this, okay? What? Have you ever had so much weed that you went crazy? Yes. Everybody in here
the paranoia
has a story. Yes, you have a story.
Paranoia,
of it.
Schizophrenia. I mean, it's close.
I mean, it'll induce insanity. I mean, I have a story.
Well, I also
I literally felt like I was going crazy.
I mean, Justin also brought something up that is, I think, also important to note is that since the legalization, the popularity. So back in the days, okay, 70s, 80s, when marijuana was also rampant and popular, even when it was quote unquote became illegal, it was pretty much weed between 5% and 11% THC levels, and hashish would maybe break 20%. Okay,
yeah.
Your basic strain of marijuana carries 20% to 30% THC, which is stronger than hashish back then. And now you got kids that are dabbing at levels at 90%.
Crazy.
I mean, you wonder.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah, that is absolutely a problem. And what happens when you legalize something like marijuana? You have
you get a market.
You get irresponsible kids that start smoking and more and more.
You start
and more.
With the vaping.
Yes,
right. Crap.
And then the next thing you know, you are dabbing and you're taking in 90%. And then they're all connected. It's all derivative of marijuana. And I'm sure it would absolutely. Now that. I bet your ass.
That's what they're saying.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons they're saying is that the strength and the potency has gone up and the amount that people are using. But what you get with that decriminalization and legalization is you get the market competing for these consumers now. Mm-hmm. And the best way to compete is to make a strongest.
No, you're right.
And I tell you what.
Well, since the demand is there.
Yeah. I mean, look, over 10 years ago, I had a family member with cancer. And this is when I got into learning about cannabis because I was trying to help her through her chemo and all that stuff. And I would go to these dispensaries and this was like 13 years ago, maybe the strains that were high in THC were like 17%. That was the high strain. 20% was like, oh my God. Like now I think that's like you said, the average is in the 20s.
Yeah.
And some of as high as 30%. Yeah. They're just breeding them to be ridiculously strong.
And you're right. The consumers have demanded that. Why? Because there's a very small percentage of the consumer that are doing it for medical purposes or for some mild reason. 80 to 90% are recreational users that are using it. When you ran clubs like I did, you were obviously, in order for the business to operate, you need consumers, you need people coming through. And I remember this because I was one of the few clubs at the time that was really trying to do everything above board and be real professional and be like a medical office. And we were really trying to change the industry. And it made it really difficult when 80% of your customers are coming in, like, which one is going to fuck me up? Which one's 10? Which one is a 10 doser? They didn't care.
The questions.
They didn't care. They didn't care. No, I'm serious. And they didn't care if it was saran wrapped and baked in someone's kitchen. So long as it was so powerful versus the one that I could tell them was organically made and it was dosed properly and it was medical and it was
no butane in it.
But if I had one that was saran wrapped and someone made it in their kitchen and it made it, you know, 10 times as strong and it was half the price, it was like that's where that would sell out and that's what everybody wanted. And so then you have these clubs that are competing because they're for profit, you know, that are competing against each other, like that drives the market. And then you have this is the outcome of that as it starts to extend out over time.
Well, a different topic. I have some stats on people's smartphone usage, which I think are interesting. Mm-hmm. And the reason what sparked me to look this up. I think
that's far more dangerous.
Huh?
I think that's
Well, what sparked me to go in this direction was
the combo of the two is really
good. My wife and I have been talking about getting off our phones more. And my 4-year-old pointed this out the other day. You know, you're distracted on your phone, which, oh God, when you hear that from your kid, like, tears your heart out. So her and I are trying to make these strategies and, you know, how to come off of them and be more present. And it just pulls to you. And they're engineered to do so. The smartest scientists in the world right now are figuring out how to make these so addictive. It's like the processed food market. It's just insane. But the stats on this are
that's why TikTok did really well.
Well, isn't that what happened? The best of the best were in cigarettes. Mm. Then they went to processed foods, and that's now they've moved to tech.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's right.
They've learned everything from gambling, casinos.
So the average person in the U.S. is on their phones for 4 hours and 43 minutes.
I think that's so low.
Average.
I think it's so low.
Check this out. So in 2019, it was 3 hours and 45 minutes. Today, it's 4 hours. It went up an hour. So it's going up.
Yeah.
It continues to go up. And it's pretty wild. The average, ready for this? The average smartphone user checks their phone 58 times a day. So, yeah, this is something we need to be careful with. And I don't think you can manage it.
You know, a good way
just by thinking about it.
You know, a good way to a good generic way. We're always talking about like simple hacks to like test things or measure things, like, because like how many people are like really tracking that. Your cell phone, the way they've made iPhone batteries with that, should not die in a day.
Oh, I was going to make that point. Same thing. If your battery dies on your phone, you've got an addiction.
Yes.
Wow.
If you have to put your phone on the charger before you go to bed, you are using your phone way too much, in my opinion.
Wow.
And I'm saying that from experience. Like, I've had times where I know that I was just working on my phone all day, texting an email, whatever, even scroll like all day long. When I'm on that, it'll die before 5-6 o'clock. Like, I'll have to look, oh shit, my battery's almost dead. So if you were using almost an entire battery on your phone, like, that is a lot of usage.
I just had that discussion with my son. That's funny you bring that up.
Yeah. It's like a good gauge, right? Yeah. It's like, you should not have to like use
his battery died and it was like, oh, well, it didn't charge fully or whatever like excuse he had. But I'm like, it's dead now. You don't use it. You don't need to use it. If you're in a point where you're using your phone that much throughout the day, you know, and you're trying to justify it, like, that's way too much. You know, you're consuming way too much.
Yeah. What we did is what we're trying is she's literally turning off all notifications and everything from 7 a.m. till the evening. And we'll see if that works. The way that I do it when I'm home is I'll take my phone and put it in a drawer, close the door. And that just creates a little barrier. If I don't do that, it just...
You have to hang it up when they get in the house.
It pulls to you. So
it's tough.
Digestive enzymes, the right ones, can help break down your protein into usable amino acids, break down your carbohydrates into energy, and your fats into fatty acids. In other words, utilize your food more effectively. This is especially true for fitness fanatics. There's a company called Bio Optimizers, that makes a product called MassZymes. These are digestive enzymes for people who are fitness-minded. Go check them out. Go to buyoptimizers.com. That's buyoptimizers.com/mindpump. Use the code mindpump10, get 10% off. All right, back to the show. This segment is brought to you by trainerwebinar.com. Adam and I get on every other month, and we teach coaches and trainers how to build a more successful business. It's totally free. Sign up at trainerwebinar.com.
Our first caller is Bonnie from South Carolina.
Bonnie, what's happening?
Hey guys. Thanks for having me on. This is such an honor, and thank you for your time. So my question is, essentially, is it bad to lift with an RPE of 8 or 9 every time I work out? I've been consistently lifting weights for the last 4 to 5 to 6 years, and I love to challenge myself every time I repeat a workout by either increasing the weight or the RPE. I usually have an RPE of 8 or 9 every time I lift. Some days I will feel sore after a workout, but not always. On the workouts where I don't increase weights, it's usually because I can't maintain proper form for the entire set. So I do think that I am really pushing myself. I work out at home in the mornings before work, and I have completed MAPS Aesthetic, Anabolic Performance 15, and Anabolic Advanced. I'm currently in week 1 of Muscle Mommy. I'm really enjoying that. My favorite program so far has been Aesthetic, and I did not feel like it was too much volume for me. Over the last year, I have been in a slight cut for 3 months, and then I stayed at or slightly above maintenance for the last 9 months. My body fat started at 33% last January, and then I went down to 30% after my cut, but it recently crept back up to 33% after I felt like I was overtraining. My sleep and my stress have been terrible this year, which also has kept me from meeting my goal, which was 25% body fat. In my cut, I was at 1,709 calories with protein at 120 grams, fat was less than 55 grams, and carbs at 200 grams. I went up to 2,000 calories during maintenance with about 250 grams being at carbs. My waist size started to increase, and I also increased my body fat during that time. I'm really frustrated because I'm doing what I think I should be doing in the gym, and my nutrition goals are set by a trainer that I check in with each month. I'm tempted to go back into a cut to see the results that I'm after. My goals are 25% body fat or have more defined abs with a waist circumference of 31 inches or less. I'm not really concerned about my weight on the scale, but I average about 150 pounds. At 30% body fat, I was 145. So again, my steps are 8 to 10,000 per day. I'm 42 years old and a former CrossFit addict. So just wanted to know if I'm right on the right track. My current macros right now are 1670 calories, protein 110 grams, carbs 184 grams, and fat 55 grams.
Okay,
you're low.
You're low
for everything you'd be doing.
Ex CrossFit addict.
Yeah.
Also based off of what you're telling me about sleep and stress. And the fact that you said
also active person, loves aesthetic. I mean, all the signs.
MAPS aesthetic is, didn't feel like overtraining. I also see you in uniform. And because I've been doing this for so long, I can pretty accurately guess that you tend to overtrain. And you're probably overtrained. You're probably overdoing everything. That's probably your tendency.
And simultaneously, okay, you have to understand too, because what you're doing isn't sound horribly low, bad overtraining, but the combination of stress, not good sleep, that low of fat you're eating nutritionally, and that I already know you're an active person. You're not a sedentary, lazy person without you even giving me your details of all day long. So in that context, you are overtrained. So understand that, because I think sometimes somebody will be like, man, I used to do CrossFit. I did all this crazy shit. Now I'm following your MAPS programs and I'm not crazy extreme. Yeah, but in the context of where you're currently at in your life with sleep, stress, activity, and in with that low calorie, it's all overtraining. Less is going to be more for you as far as results.
Why is your sleep bad? Explain, give us a little bit of detail on that.
I have a 4-year-old son who likes to wake up every night, and it's difficult just getting into a routine with him. It's erratic. He'll wake up sometimes at 1, sometimes at 2, sometimes at 12. It just depends on how he's sleeping. And I travel quite a bit for work, so that's hard for me to get into a a good sleep routine as well, because I've got four states that I'm in charge of, so I'm constantly somewhere. I'm going somewhere every week usually. Okay. So.
The best advice I could give you for sleep in that sense, would be to go to bed an hour and a half or 2 hours earlier than you normally do, to give yourself the buffer of kid waking me up and the travel. So most people, it's like, okay, go to bed about 8.5 hours before you want to wake up. That's pretty standard for most people, sometimes a little less. But if you're going to get woken up in the middle of the night and you travel a lot, you probably want to go to bed about 9.5 hours before bed. And if you can, even 10 hours before, because you'll get that wake up in the middle and it's not going to harm you as much. The sleep, the lack of sleep, the cumulative effects of a little bit of lack of sleep completely derail your ability to recover, build muscle, burn body. Your body wants to hold on to body fat. It makes workouts just too much damage on the body. So that'd be the first place I would go. Second place is I would bump your fat.
Yes.
Very rarely do I have a woman go as low as 50 grams or 55 grams of body fat. Most of the women I've ever worked with, 65 to 70, would be the lowest I would go. And they just seem to get better results. Fat's essential, especially for hormones and your nervous system. So I'd bump your fat a little bit. I wouldn't go into deficit. Muscle Mommy, the volume is not bad. So you could try that, but you probably are better off backing off and going like MAPS 15, improving your sleep. Once you start to feel great, then go back to Muscle Mommy. And what you'll see in that is not a ton of results initially. You'll just start to feel better.
Yeah.
And then you'll start to feel better. And then you'll start to notice, oh, wow, my body's starting to respond again. And then that's when you know you're really moving in the right direction.
The hardest part for you, Bonnie, is going to be doing the right thing for long enough to let your body completely recover and then respond the way you want it to, and being patient. Right. That's going to be the hardest thing. Your body has adapted to your level of intensity, and it's very resilient, and it's been able to survive through this. And so feeding it, reducing the volume and intensity for a while, like Sal saying, you're not going to see this initial, like, oh, guys told me to just bump my calories and go to MAPS 15. And I should, well, no, you're not going to see it right away. You'll just start feeling better, sleeping better. And then you need to hang there for a little bit before we go and try and ramp up the intensity. I would love to see, if you were my client, I'd put you on MAPS 15. I'd bump your calories slightly, and I'd do it through fat. And we would do that for at least a month or two in that direction before I let you go back the other direction. And the goal really would be, can we not put on any more body fat, but slowly increase your calories and get you to a place more like 2,600, 2,800 plus calories, and maintaining your sleeping well, feeling good, maintaining your body fat percentage and weight right around there while also increasing calories. That would get you in a good place to go back and cut. Yeah. and then pick up a little bit of volume or intensity.
Yeah. By the way, some of the signs of overtraining are poor sleep, but it can also look like this. Your kid wakes you up, you get them back down, maybe they lie in bed with you, and then it takes you forever to go back to sleep. Or sometimes you can't go back to sleep. That's also a sign of overtraining. So what it should be like, unless of course your kid's actually actively keeping you awake, but what it should be like is your kid walks in your room, wakes you up, 15 minutes, get him settled, maybe go back in his bed, maybe lays in bed with you, and then you're able to fall back asleep. But if you find yourself kind of like amped, first, like you can't get back to sleep and I'm tossing and turning, that's a sign that your body's overstressed.
Yeah, I usually don't have an issue falling back to sleep. So
good.
Well, that's good.
Good.
That's good.
Good. But everything else, I think we still follow exactly what we're saying. And I think what you'll see is you'll start to feel stronger, starting to feel better. Definitely the direction is not to do more and cut, for sure. If you do more and cut, you're going to set yourself up in a pretty bad way. But just kind of back off, let everything heal a little bit, see if we can get the sleep to get better. And then after, like Adam said, 4 weeks, 8 weeks, then we'll go MAPS Muscle Mommy, maybe start cutting the calories down a little bit, and then you should see your body responding pretty well and feel good.
Okay. Now, I've done MAPS 15 before. I did the advanced version. As far as like the, going back to my question, the RPE, should I be like taking the weights back down a little bit, just focusing on a moderate intensity instead of trying to really push the weight, because I really like to maintain what I've done in the past or challenge myself even more.
You won't lose it.
Increasing your calories and giving yourself more healthy fats and following MAPS 15 advanced without training a failure or trying to push, you'll maintain every bit of muscle you have. You're not going to lose. You're definitely not going to lose.
The more reverse, you can recover.
Reverse dieting and training that program. And hopefully if we do this right, you organically get stronger and the weights go up over weeks, right? Like you shouldn't have to train to failure and struggle every workout as hard as you can to just to see the weight slowly increase. Hopefully you stop two reps from failure and just feel good after your workouts, but you notice after weeks two or three, oh wow, the weight's on the bar is going up. That's what I'd want to see. Yeah. Not you pushing to get the more weight on the bar, the body just going like, oh, this is getting easier for me because you've taken care of it that way. So don't fear the reduction in intensity is going, your body won't lose that muscle, not in a calorie surplus and taking care of yourself, rest, like you're going to maintain at the bare minimum, if not gain.
Yeah. I think that's the experiment we'd love to see you go through because, you know, giving your body more of that space and that adequate time to recover, you're going to notice that you're going to increase strength just from that alone. Like pressing yourself is one method, right? But until it doesn't work for you, and that's part of the formula. But if you're not recovering, we're not going to advance, we're not going to progress. And so to progress, we really need to focus on the ability to get that recovery.
Yeah, and just to make you feel better, I mean the data on this is pretty clear. Like keeping muscle requires very little.
Yeah,
it requires very little to keep muscle, so I wouldn't worry about it at all. And even if you did lose a little strength, it would come back and then some so fast after getting your body back on track. But the other side of this coin is if you stay on the path you are now, you're going to start to lose strength and muscle.
Yeah.
So it's really not like a, in my opinion, it's a no-brainer.
Bonnie, are you?
Yeah, I've already noticed a little bit of decrease in my strength from a deadlift perspective. So
Yep. Bonnie, are you in our private forum?
I don't believe I am. No,
I'm gonna
have on Facebook.
Yeah, I'm gonna have okay. Doug send that to you, so you're in there with us. And then as you go through this process, because I know the part that'll be hard for you. It's not, you're not the type of person it's hard to follow instruction and go through. It's the mental part of being patient,
not going hard.
Yeah, not going hard. So I'm gonna put you in there, and I want you to use it like that to check in with us. Even if you're frustrated as you're going through this process, or you have the temptation to want to do more, just check in with us. Let us know how you're feeling, what's going on, and then hopefully we'll help you get through this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
You got it. All right, Bonnie. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Yeah,
it's so hard. This is, I'd say, one of the hardest types of clients to help because, you know, someone like that, you know, she's disciplined.
Go get her.
Yeah. You know, she's disciplined.
Just her concept and tolerance of overtraining, overstress is different.
Yeah.
So for her to be like, I didn't feel like I was overtraining. You have a strong tolerance. You can push through.
Press further than most people.
That's right. That's right. So, and look, especially I've trained quite a few women who also served in the military, and like clockwork, they all go towards beating the crap out of themselves. Yeah. They all skew in that direction.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very difficult to bring them back.
Our next caller is Elijah from Arkansas.
What's up, man?
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. How can we help you?
So my protein intake is 200 grams. My calories is at 26,000. Sometimes I find myself hitting my protein target like very easy, but I'll only eat like 1700 grams or 1700 calories or like 1800 calories. So I leave a lot on the table. So I was wondering, am I okay with continue doing that? Or should I try to hit that 2633 calories?
Yeah.
What's the goal?
What's your goal and how tall and how much you weigh?
I'm 5'9". I weigh 223 right now. My goal was to build muscle. So I just took an in-home like two weeks ago. I'm at 100 skeletal muscle and 26% body fat. So I was looking to cut after this, but I wanted to see what I should do first.
Protein's important, but so are calories. And you're not, first of all, how are you hitting 1600, 1700 calories at 200 grams of protein? What are you eating? Like tilapia and chicken breasts?
Basically, yeah. And then like low vegetables.
No. You need fat too. So the calories are important, just like protein is. You can have enough protein, but your calories are so low that your body's going to use that protein for energy, not for repair. And you need fat and carbohydrates, but fats especially as well. So, and 1700 calories is really low for a guy your size. I think sticking around 2500, 2600 calories is fine. You should be able to get a nice recomp with that, little muscle, some fat loss at the same time. But the way I would do it is I would just introduce fattier cuts of meat.
Yeah.
You know, get some more fats in there. Just, you know, stay away from you're doing like the pre-contest bodybuilder sources of protein, which is weird. Like most people would do that on purpose. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I would go with fattier cuts of meat and chicken and fish, and throw in some nuts in there, some olive oil on the vegetables, add some more rice or whatever your carb sources are. Keep it around 2,500. Be consistent with that.
Elijah, what MAPS program are you following right now?
I'm doing MAPS Strong.
And then, how you liking it? How's the consistency for you on it? Is it your first MAPS program? You ran other ones?
I've done anabolic advance, bands, aesthetic. Strong by far is my favorite, because it resembles a lot of what I used to do back in like high school and college and playing, like doing football and stuff. So it keeps me very consistent. And I like that 5 days a week and those 2 days off.
Yeah. If you're consistent with that, we need to feed you. Like you need to get those calories up. And I'm with Sal. The easiest way to do that, to not overcomplicate it, is just give yourself fattier cuts, you know, tri-tip, ribeye, like enjoy some meat. Those healthy fats are only going to serve you. And the focus really would be right now on reverse dieting, getting strong. You know, that would be the goal before we even consider cutting. Because I'd like to see you, a cut is more like 2300 calories. That would be a cut. And in order for that to be a cut, we need to get you up over 2600 calories consistently in order for 2022 to be a cut. And so that would be the main focus, is getting those calories up, focusing on and getting strong in the gym for a while. You're obviously doing good with the protein. And again, the easy advice would be just enjoy some fattier meats.
Yeah. Instead of like chicken breasts, you know, I would go chicken thighs with the skin, fattier cuts of meat. Instead of egg whites, eat the whole egg. You know, instead of tilapia, you could go to salmon, you know, throw in some nuts, some avocado.
I'm assuming you're pretty low carb too on that little calories too. Are you low carb? You're not getting carbs in?
Here and there, yeah. I mainly just eat rice. I don't eat as much bread because bread like really sticks to my body. So it makes me feel bloated.
That's a good choice. I like that. Rice, sweet potato, yams, quinoa, potatoes, all great sources.
Yeah.
So, you know, stick to carbs like that. And yeah, honestly, just continue to eat whole foods, but enjoy fattier meats and keep those that calorie intake up. It's gonna be real hard for you to build, even if you're hitting your grams of protein, hard to build a guy your size on only 1700 calories,
hard.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. I just thought maybe I was good because I still was building muscle and I felt me building strength with me hitting that protein intake. So I thought I was good, but I wanted to check in to make sure.
You'll feel even better. The fact that you're still responding is a good sign.
Yeah, that's a real good sign.
So if you stay consistent, 2500 calories
is gonna help.
Yeah, you can respond even better.
Okay, cool.
Elijah, are you in our private forum?
No, I'm not.
I'm going to have Doug hook you up with that so we can keep an eye on you, and you just check in with us as this goes.
Okay, I appreciate that.
All right, brother.
You got it, man.
All right.
Take it easy.
You guys have a good one.
You too.
Good one. That's not as common for people watching, but sometimes you'll see that. That was more common back when I was a trainer, when people are afraid of taking in, you know, eating fat, because most people don't voluntarily eat, you know, boiled skinless chicken breasts and tilapia. But I saw what he wrote, 200 grams of protein,
very bodybuilder,
1700 calories. I'm like, you're eating like just protein to make that happen.
Yeah, totally.
That's really hard to do.
Chicken breast and fish, like you said.
Gross.
I mean, that's pretty
super dry and unpleasant.
And it doesn't need to be that difficult. You know, we constantly talk about how, man, if you just eat whole foods, right? Like a guy like this, literally, like, just don't overcomplicate this. Continue eating the whole foods, like, because you to stay that low and that high of protein, you're eating whole foods,
right?
So he's eating whole foods. Stick to that, but enjoy the fattier meats. It'll naturally bring the calories up. They bring the fat up too. Low fat too on a guy like you. We may be able to do it for a short period of time, but it'll make a difference. and he'll feel the difference.
Messes up your hormones.
Oh yeah, strength wise. So the fact that he actually had positive in that is just, he's going to see a huge difference, I think. So
our next caller is Danny from Nevada.
Danny, what's up, man?
What's going on, Danny?
How can we help you?
Hey guys, good to see you guys again. Hey, so I am back for a second time calling in here. I called it about 9 months ago because I was looking for some advice on how to balance time in the gym while also I was getting into the throes of training for my first ever half Ironman. And I was doing all that while also finishing up a PhD in mechanical engineering. So you guys kind of pointed me towards MAPS Performance. And I really appreciated that because the low volume there kind of really helped get that, manage all those lifestyle stressors that I had going on. So in following what you suggested, I was able to obviously finish up the PhD, which is great. And I also finished my Ironman 40 minutes faster than I had intended to.
Wow.
So anyways, all that to say is it, you know, worked out like a charm. So my new question here, fast forward 9 months later, now that we're kind of in the winter months, I am still a very dedicated hobbyist athlete. I consider myself like almost a weekday warrior is what I wrote in my email, because I'm basically skiing every day. I do some jujitsu, you know, some combat sports. I'm also getting into a little bit of tactical training. So I was doing my PhD in Austin and I actually relocated to Reno, the Reno Tahoe area to do a bunch of skiing. So I'm just across the mountains from you guys now, which is really exciting. But my question is, basically in short, I really enjoyed training and kind of that like athlete style training, you know, some of those explosive movements, some sprints, some kettlebell ballistics, some of those isometric holds, the eccentric focus, stuff like that, that comes with performance. And I think the volume is really well moderated for some of my other pursuits, like the skiing and the combat sports and that, this, that, and the other. So my question is basically, as a quote unquote athlete, even if I'm not necessarily professional, it's just more hobbyist. I really like that style of training. Can someone like me, or I guess anyone who has some athletic goals, just kind of run that type of training indefinitely?
Yep.
Or should I go ahead and mix in like a symmetry or something every 12 weeks? Or is that performance really just geared to kind of be run forever?
You're good.
I mean, you're good with that program.
You'd be fine with symmetry too, but performance is so well balanced.
And it's so perfect for the amount of stuff he's doing right now.
Yeah.
Because he's talking about just so the audience, 15 performance.
Yeah.
So that program
is perfect.
For somebody who's moving as much as you are already. Symmetry actually has a little bit more volume than that.
Yeah, symmetry would be too much volume.
Yeah, you don't even need that. I think it's a perfect program for you to run. And we do. Here's the reason we always tell people to every year to run at least one cycle of symmetry or performance. And the reason for that is to address multi-planar movements, unilateral work, stuff like that. That program addresses all of that in there. And because you're also doing a bunch of
you're doing it in real life anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're doing all those movements.
It's a perfect balance for you. Really, if you were my client, the way I would be adjusting you is kind of more on a week-to-week basis off of the volume of other stuff you're doing. So let's say it's like I'm sure you've had these crazy weeks where every day you're doing something crazy intense. I'm like, hey, let's scale back a little bit on the days this week of training and just do one day or whatever. And then days where you're not as crazy intense out there, we might do more. That's it. I would play with the amount of MAPS 15 you're doing per week, but that type of training you could do indefinitely with what you've got going on.
The only piece of advice I would have for you is if you ever go through a period where you're doing a lot less of the outdoor athletic pursuits and you're going to spend more time in the gym for whatever reason, but you like that style of training, you could go with our traditional MAPS for performance, which is not the 15 version, but the more volume one. Or you could try fun programs like Strong or Old-Time Strength, which someone like you would love.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I just actually picked up Old-Time Strength probably like 3 or 4 months ago, and I haven't really investigated it yet, but it just seemed really cool. Yeah. So, you know, maybe come the late spring, pre-summer, you know, when there's still some snow on the ground, but not enough to ski it, I'll look into doing something like that. That'd probably be pretty fun.
Wait till your activity levels kind of come down a bit and then devote a little bit more time. And you're going to notice it's very involved, but it's like, it's going to challenge your body in so many new ways. You're going to love it.
You'll get a kick out of it. Well, hey, what mountain are you riding up there?
Oh God, I kind of go all over the place. Right now I'm in the Lodge of Mount Rose, which is kind of a tiny little private mountain up near Incline Village kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I'll go down to Heavenly. I'll do some of the South Lake stuff. I also ride Olympic Valley, like Palisades Alpine, pretty frequently. And this season specifically, I've been getting into more backcountry. So like hiking up, you know, where there's not actually a resort, and then skiing down and wearing all my avalanche gear, of course. So I'm not dying out there. But that's been really fun. I kind of go all over. I just
very cool
wherever awesome. There's the best snow. Yeah,
cool. That's awesome. So you got 40 minutes better than you thought. That's remarkable.
Yeah,
that's not
yeah.
a little
so
bit.
So my goal
dude.
Was
that's
6 hours. I finished in 5:25.
Wow.
So it was great. It was. I trained really well, and I credit at least part of that to you guys.
Yeah, awesome. Good job, man. Well,
I was able to
love hearing it.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks for your time today. I do want to. If you don't mind, I want to share like just a quick little anecdote on how you guys have, obviously you helped me out with Ironman, but I realized kind of in hindsight that you guys helped me out with I know you guys hear all the time, oh, you've helped change my life for the better, but I have kind of a unique example of that just in listening to some of your guys's, I guess, ways of approaching training. Growing up and like throughout my whole life, like a lot of people, I have kind of dealt with like, you know, some anxiety, self-confidence issues, nothing new. Like everybody goes through that. And so last summer I decided, okay, I'm going to start working with a therapist and try to figure some of this stuff out, where it comes from. And so I was talking with my first therapist about this notion of like self-confidence and how to build it. And he told me one day, he was like, hey, here's how we're going to help your self-confidence. What we're going to do first is strip away all of your self-limiting beliefs and then work on the action of building that self-confidence, taking action on it. And then he made this analogy and he was like, picture it as if you're obese and trying to get in shape. The first thing we're going to do is not build the muscle. We're going to do a bunch of cardio and try to strip all that weight off and put you in a calorie deficit. Mm-hmm. And my jaw literally dropped. I was like, oh shit. Like, maybe this guy's got it totally backwards. So I ended up swapping therapists and working with a guy whose mantra is more like, feelings follow action. So like building the muscle of confidence to get those feelings working for you, having the evidence base that you can act confidently and the feelings follow. And it's been like completely life changing. So I thought immediately of you guys when that guy brought it up.
What a great story. What a great story.
That's been my last 6 months, and it's been incredibly helpful. So you guys are making waves in more ways than you realize probably. Cool. So, anyways, yeah, that all sounds great. I just wanted to throw that in and share it, and I will go ahead and stay the course with performance at least through ski season, and then maybe, you know, look into some of that old time stuff.
Awesome, man. Awesome, Danny. Thank you, bro. Brother. Great killer, story, dude. Bro. Appreciate that.
Yeah, of course, guys. Yeah. Let me know. I know I'm just across the mountains, so if you guys are ever skiing yourselves up at the Tahoe place or want to catch a pump in Reno or something, hit me up. I'd love to
Link
up and get some snowboard turns in.
Right on, Danny.
Man, sure. Thank you.
All right, guys. Catch you later. Have a good one.
I only sled.
what a great story.
It's so funny that
he's amazing.
He made that connection. Like, oh, no. He's like, oh shoot, this might be the best guy for me.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with someone else. I love that. You know what's funny about that with therapy? I've been listening, you know, Adam Lane Smith, we've been on the show a couple times. He says so much therapy is directed towards female psychology.
Yeah, yeah.
That they'll apply to men.
I remember when he said that.
And it messes them up. He says, and the whole action, like feelings follow action, that really resonates with men quite a bit in particular. Adam talks about that. So cool.
Our next caller is Brittany from Texas.
Hi, Brittany.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you? Good. How can we help you?
Good. So a little bit of background on me is I'm 40 years old. I'm a hairstylist. I run two salons in Texas. And I started strength training about 10 years ago. I was introduced to it through CrossFit. But that was also around the time I discovered I had Hashimoto's. I'm sure you guys have heard of that. Autoimmune disease that attacks your thyroid. After kind of working with traditional doctors and not really getting anywhere, I found a functional medicine doctor, and she was awesome. She got me to quit the CrossFit, focus on more low impact workouts, and change my diet. And we got my Hashimoto's under control. Fast forward to COVID, a lot of stress happened in my life then. Didn't really get to work out as much. Then had some major life event happen probably 2.5 years ago. Got back into strength training, but was probably vastly under eating. I did a DEXA scan a couple of months ago just to see where I was kind of at. I didn't really know, even though I've been strength training probably consistently for 3 years. And my body fat percentage was pretty high. It was like 30%. So then I started to really try to dial in my nutrition. I started my calories at about 2,200, retested about a month after that first DEXA, and my weight had gone down a little bit, but my body fat percentage and my muscle mass had gone down. Fast forward to now, a little bit of an update since I emailed you guys. I'm now eating about 2,500 calories. I'm following MAPS 15, so I really dialed back the intensity, but I'm just really trying to focus on gaining strength and not so much aesthetics. What I'm noticing is my strength is not really where I feel like it should be for someone that's been training as long as I have. So my question to you guys was, do you think autoimmunity, Hashimoto specifically, can play a role in not being able to put on as much muscle as the average person?
Yes, but Hashimoto's in particular responds very strongly to overstress. All autoimmune does. But I'm gonna tell you this from my experience, Brittany. I've never met a salon owner who wasn't under a ton of stress. It's a very, very stressful business to own, and you own two of them.
Yeah.
You're a mom too?
No. I'm single. Okay. So yeah.
Okay. And you had something tough. You went through something tough recently, you said, a couple years ago?
It was a divorce. Yeah.
You're on the right path with MAPS 15 and moving your calories. I mean, you got to give it time.
How do you feel since you're bumped the calories to that?
I feel good. Definitely. Yeah. I'm just not seeing my strength progress, especially because like I watched your journey, Adam, and I know men are totally different and somebody who doesn't have Hashimoto's is way different and someone that's been training like you is way different. But I thought with the little bit of experience I've had training in the last few years that like some sort of muscle memory, or maybe I accidentally built some muscle back then, but when I did my scan and just based on the strength now, I feel good to answer your question, but I don't know if my strength is where it should be. It just feels like I'm not making strength gains like I want to.
The health has to, it comes before the strength.
Yeah.
Sure.
So if you're noticing improvements in health, like energy, sleep's a little better, feel a little bit more calm, less stressed, my hot cold tolerance is better, hair and nails start to feel better, digestion starts to improve, then the strength tends to follow. But you went through something very difficult. You have a tendency towards Hashimoto's. You own two businesses, so being a business owner is already a lot of work. There's salons, which are just filled with drama and work. So and you laugh because you know exactly what I'm talking about. You're on the right path. Stay on the path and use your health as a guide. And then what'll happen is the strength will follow, and then the muscle and the fat loss will follow. But health has to come first.
Okay.
Yeah.
I knew you guys were going to say that.
Yeah. Trust the process. You're doing good. You're doing really good. Yeah. You look good. You sound healthy. You sounds like you're in a good place right now. Just give it some time.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an overnight thing for sure. But hey, keep following. And how far into the program are you? And it's been for you right now. Was it a month or two? Would you say?
Yeah, it's been about a month. Yeah.
Oh, you're so on the right path. Yeah, it's early. You got to give it at least another two months. You got to give it a good 90 days, and then you'll start to see things turning around. What positive effects are you noticing? I know, forget strength, but you said you feel better. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I feel better. Just I don't have brain fog like I used to. I was just running on like major stress before, and just really that, cause I was following a bodybuilder split before I found you guys. And I couldn't tell, it's hard to know like what was low energy, cause I was going through a divorce. So like my stress was just really high. So I think I just felt like, I was like, oh yeah, I have high energy. Like I'm good. Like I'm fine. And then I kind of crashed out. I also had surgery a year ago. I kind of crashed out after the surgery because my body told me I had to heal. And I just started putting on weight, but I was like trying to be nice to myself too. I was like, well, I just had surgery. I just went through a divorce. Like I'm going to just chill for a little bit. And I still trained, but I really dialed back the intensity. I just wasn't following like a set program. But I do notice a difference from post-divorce, post-surgery. Like I definitely feel much better. Sleep is good. Energy is good. Clarity is there. Yeah. So like all the feelings are there, which is good.
Yeah, you're on the right path. You got to give it at least another 2 months, if not more. But I'd give it another. And then what'll happen is your body will start to respond, and it's going to feel like weird. What's going on? I'm not even doing anything else, and my body's starting to look and feel different. But what you're noticing with the energy and all that, that's such a positive thing. But you just started, you're healing from a pretty, it was a pretty bad place, as it sounds like. Mm-hmm. And you're coming out of that, and that takes a little while. It doesn't just happen in a
month. What do you want her to run after 15?
I think 15 for a while. And then if you go to a higher volume program, anabolic or muscle mommy would be the two programs I think would be appropriate volume. But I would go for at least another 60 days with mass. You're not doing anything else, right? No cardio, anything like that?
No. Okay. My steps I get in at work, so yeah. I feel like I don't need to do anything else.
No, you're good. And then, by the way, what you noticed after with that, during that stressful period where you were kind of hyper, that is a very common stress response.
The cortisol.
Very damaging to the body as well. Mm-hmm. And then eventually what people do notice is that crash. And so, yeah, very normal what you experience. But you're healing. What you're feeling right now is your body's you're coming out of the hole. You're not out yet, but you're coming out of the hole. So you're moving in the right direction for sure.
Brittany, are you taking a day a week or so? Do you have a day that you just kind of completely relax, shut down, go for a nice long walk and stroll, or do any sort of yoga? Do you have anything like any practices like that?
I'm trying. I try to dedicate at least one day a week to doing nothing or something I want to do. Like, I've taken up photography, so like I go take pictures and drive around and stuff. But yeah, it is hard. You're probably going to say like, it's probably hard for me to do that, which it is. Yep. I think I'm addicted to the cortisol or the adrenaline sometimes. Totally.
That's why I bring that up. I think that that would also serve you, is to just be conscious of that and trying to make an effort at least on a weekly basis to have a day like that, that is, you know, more working inward, you know, doing stuff.
But
like
don't
that.
Turn it into work.
Right. Yeah. No.
Yeah. Don't turn it into work. Turn it into relax.
Yeah. I love the idea of walking and hiking to spots to take photography. Mm-hmm. I think that's great. Stuff like things that's passion and fills your bucket in other ways. So, that practice will serve you also.
Just for some perspective, give us accurate hours that you work on a weekly basis. Like how many, like what do your hours look like during the week?
Well, I work 11 to 7. I was working 5 days a week. But now I dialed that back. Like 2 months ago, my doctor suggested I dial that back. So now I'm working 4 days a week. And I know it doesn't equal 40 hours, but when you're standing all day, it's a lot.
Plus you're managing other people.
Well, yes, there is a little bit of that. Thankfully I've outsourced a lot of that. But it's mostly like the client interaction I'm learning. Like I've been doing hair for 15 years, and probably in the last like 5 years, I'm finally learning.
You pick up
that interaction is like a major energy exchange.
Yeah. It's you pick up all their energy.
It's very similar to personal training.
Yeah.
If you work with five people in a row, there's no break. It's five. Yeah. You're on.
You know, since you recognize that, you know that there's a lot of value too. And just at the end of your day, doing something that really allows you to decompress, nice walk, nice warm bath, things that'll help you kind of detach from all that energy you've picked up from clients all day. I know that sounds kind of woo woo, but I'm a big believer.
Very woo woo right now. Yeah. Bring it.
Yeah. So yeah, you know, if doing practices like that, that's all going to serve you. And okay. I think you'll see the strength and all those things start to come the better you are at taking care of yourself in that direction.
Totally.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well, thank you guys so much. I appreciate you.
You right, got buddy. It. You're doing good.
Thank you.
Thank you. I've never met a salon owner or a restaurant owner that wasn't just.
Well, it takes a special person to do those.
Bro, you're dealing with so many people, so much drama, so many chaos. It's constant.
Well, and I didn't want to dig too much, but like I know there's a lot of alcohol being passed around in salons and my wife has Hashimoto's and it's such a not a good combo.
No, big
just,
trigger
just to be cognizant of that. Is a big thing.
Alcohol and gluten are the big ones for.
You know, we really didn't dive into her diet that much to ask her questions about that, because that could also. You're right.
Well, she said she's bumping her calories.
Well, she also said she's working with a specialist, hopefully they've got her on the right path nutritionally.
Sounds like they got it turned around.
Good. Look, if you like our show, come find us on Instagram. Justin is at Mind Pump Justin. I'm at Mind Pump DeStefano. Adam is at Mind Pump Adam.
Thank you for listening to Mind Pump. If your goal is to build and shape your body, dramatically improve your health and energy, and maximize your overall performance, check out our discounted RGB Super Bundle at mindpumpmedia.com. The RGB Super Bundle includes MAPS Anabolic, MAPS Performance, and MAPS Aesthetic, 9 months of phased expert exercise programming designed by Sal, Adam, and Justin to systematically transform the way your body looks, feels, and performs. With detailed workout blueprints and over 200 videos, the RGB Super Bundle is like having Sal, Adam, and Justin as your own personal trainers, but at a fraction of the price. The RGB Super Bundle has a full 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can get it now plus other valuable free resources at mindpumpmedia.com. If you enjoy this show, please share the love by leaving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes and by introducing Mind Pump to your friends and family. We thank you for your support, and until next time, this is Mind Pump.